You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.
There's got to be a better way to light up the world today. Something that we need, something safe and clean. Well, if you're searching, you can find the answer right before your eyes. It's atomic. It's atomic. There's no need to fear. We gotta let the whole world hear. It's atomic. It's atomic. It's atomic.
And now here's Rod Adams and Shane Brown with The Atomic Show.
It's atomic. It's atomic.
This is Rod Adams coming to you from Millington, Tennessee.
And this is Shane Brown coming to you from Los Lunas, New Mexico. And it's time for The Atomic Show, number...
40.
Wow. Yeah.
And tonight we have with us a guest. His name is Kirk Sorensen, and he is the rapidly growing in popularity author of Energy from Thorium, a blog with a rather interesting technology bent that is gaining some real traction.
Thank you very much, Ron. I appreciate that.
Yeah, no problem.
If that's your perception, then that's great.
Well, of course, I don't get a chance to look at your statistics, but I have occasionally read between the lines of a few major journalists who've begun mentioning that thorium is a alternative nuclear fuel which will do some interesting things, including expanding the resource base, and also has some properties that may make it a little bit more palatable for people in terms of using it for a rapidly expanding nuclear power industry.
Yeah, I think so. I think it has some very intriguing properties that have not been fully appreciated, which is one of the reasons I wanted to start the blog and get some discussion going about it.
So when did you first get interested in thorium as a reactor fuel?
Well, actually, it's kind of Rod's fault that I got interested in thorium.
Because oops. I introduced a competitor.
About 6 years ago, I was just poking around the internet a little bit, and I found Rod's site, and I think I spent the better part of the afternoon reading just about every article on there. But one of them that I found very interesting was an article about the light water breeder reactor, where he mentioned that they had installed this thorium uranium-233 core in the shipping port reactor in the late 1970s, and that you were actually able to breed in thorium in a thermal spectrum with slowed down neutrons. And that was something I didn't know before. All I'd ever heard about nuclear energy was light water reactors and liquid metal fast breeder reactors. And so thorium was something different and new. And about the same time, I was fortunate that I had a colleague, and he had worked at Oak Ridge National Labs, and he had this dusty old book from the library called Fluid Fuel Reactors, written in 1958.
Gotta love those dusty library books.
Curiously, yeah, I found that book in every technical library I've looked for it in. It's pretty widely distributed.
Oh, really? Okay. That was the first time I'd seen it, and so I took it home and I started reading it, and it's a hefty tome, but I found out that, boy, the United States tried to build thorium reactors back in the 50s and 60s, several different kinds, in fact, and they all had some things in common, that at least these attempts were fluid-fueled reactors. They didn't carry the fissile fuel in a solid form. They had it in a liquid form. And at first that seemed very strange to me. I thought, well, why would you want to do that? But then as I read more, I found out there were some very distinct safety and performance advantages to doing it that way. And there was one in particular that really lent itself well to doing it with thorium. And that is thorium has an intermediate product. When you're burning thorium, you make this in-between stuff on the way to making uranium-233 called protactinium, and it likes to gobble up neutrons. And so you have two solutions to this. You either get the protactinium out of the reactor and let it decay to uranium-233, or you reduce the flux in a reactor real low. So a fluid field reactor can actually do the first step, whereas the solid core reactor has a real hard time reprocessing all the time. So I realized that there was a real synergy between fluid-fueled reactors and thorium, and that it made more sense to me why solid-fueled reactors hadn't used the thorium very much up to that point.
So how long does the protactinium need to be out of the reactor before it decays?
Well, the protactinium has a 27-day half-life, so if you took 100 kilograms out, 27 days later, half of it would be decayed. The real trick is you want to take it out and never put it back in. You want to let it decay to uranium-233 and then put that back in. And because
it's
protactinium... Pardon me?
I was going to say that only takes 9 months for it to go through 10 half-lives, which brings it down to a tenth of a percent of its original concentration, the
SP233. Exactly. And that is one of the issues, though, when you're trying to reprocess solid thorium fuel, is the residual protactinium in there is quite an issue to deal with. But it's chemically distinct from thorium, so you can use chemical processes to separate it, and then when it decays to uranium, it's chemically distinct again from the protactinium, so you can use chemical processes to take it out and put it back in the reactor. So it's sort of like nature gave us a basic chemical trick to pull this off with, and as you know, chemical separation is infinitely easier to do than isotopic separation. So.
Well, and sometimes it's a good thing that it takes a lot of technology to separate isotopes.
Yeah, sometimes that is a good thing. Exactly.
So, Kirk, what do you have in mind for liquid-fueled thorium reactors? Are you just a font of information, or do you have some plans to maybe do something with this technology yourself?
Well, I don't know. I certainly don't have any concrete plans right now. I would really hope someone would do something with this technology, and that's sort of part of been my motivation for wanting to get this information out, is to I sort of view myself as somebody who's holding up this, shiny trinket going, is this good? Is this good? Because it sure looks good to me. What do you guys think? I think it looks pretty good. Tell me if I'm wrong here, but here's why I think it's good, And, go ahead.
I was going to say most of the people at Oak Ridge who got involved with it came away from it really, really impressed with the technology, and that many senior nuclear scientists and engineers at Oak Ridge cannot possibly be wrong.
Oh, I don't know.
Well, the funny thing is I've talked to a few of them, and some of the people I've talked to, there's not many left. In fact, most of them have passed away, but... some of them actually are quite bitter that the United States didn't take this path. They feel like the liquid fluoride reactor was rejected for bad reasons, and that it really represented a superior solution to our future energy needs.
And there's a lot of people in various aspects of nuclear technology that have the same feeling. I know that people that I've talked to who like fast liquid-fueled reactors also feel the same way.
Liquid-cooled reactors?
I'm sorry, you're right. Liquid metal-cooled reactors is what I'm saying.
Okay,
that whole group up from Argonne National Laboratory is occasionally says, wow, we should have gone this direction. And even today, they'll try it out. Well, there really isn't enough uranium to go around, so we've got to go back to those fast reactors.
Well, that's actually how the liquid fluoride reactor lost out in the late 60s. The Atomic Energy Commission had heavily invested in liquid metal fast breeders, and the liquid fluoride reactor running on thorium was perceived as a competition to that heavy investment. I mean, they had reactors like Fermi 1 that were getting ready to run, and again, some of this isn't written down. Some of this comes from talking to people who were actually there, but they essentially told me, we got a snow job done on us because they'd already decided on the liquid metal fast breeder and they needed to kill us to perpetuate it. Ironically, in the next decade, the Clinch River breeder was proposed and they started working on it, but it was ultimately killed in the early 80s. So the decision to get rid of the fluoride reactor in favor of the sodium fast breeder, we didn't end up doing the sodium fast breeder either. So.
Now, you've written on the blog about another technology which isn't as well known as fluoride reactors, and those were chloride reactors for destruction of actinides.
Yeah, the chloride reactor is it's one of these things that I came up with the idea and thought how clever and original I was, and, you know, I'm sure there's some patent waiting for me, and then did a little more investigating the library only to find out that it had been studied rather extensively by a few different people in the 60s and 70s. So one scientist in particular, I can't pronounce his first name, he's Polish, Dr. Taub in Switzerland, spent much of the 60s and 70s researching chloride reactors that would have a fast spectrum, because chloride is much larger than fluorine, or chlorine is bigger than fluorine, and so it tends to moderate neutrons far less than fluorine does. Fluorine is just too light. It's too good a moderator, so you can't really build a fast spectrum fluoride reactor. But you not only can build a fast spectrum chloride reactor, but it's a very fast spectrum. It's a very hard spectrum. And he wrote a lot of papers on this, and what a good reactor it would be for, as a fast breeder reactor, a liquid chloride fast breeder. He was looking essentially to do the same sort of thing that they wanted to do with a liquid metal fast breeder, burn uranium in a fast spectrum. None of these chloride reactors were ever actually built. They were just a paper concept, whereas the fluoride reactors, two were built at Oak Ridge and successfully operated. But I think today it would be very intriguing to investigate the chloride reactor as a way to get rid of these pesky, long-lived actinides that that make us have to have places like Yucca Mountain. And, you know, Rod, you've written a number of times about this, about, you know, Yucca Mountain. I can't remember how you put it. It was the right question, wrong answer. I don't know. How did you put that?
Yeah, I wrote a piece one time called Yucca Mountain, Right Answer to the Wrong Question. And that dates back to a notation that we used to find on our papers sometimes at nuclear power school. There you often have to answer questions. They're all essay questions. There's no such thing as a multiple choice question at Navy Nuclear Power School. And so people would start off and read the question and not read it very carefully. And so they would go off into a long essay and get everything right, except that they were answering a question that wasn't really asked. And that's the way I feel about Yucca Mountain. It, you know, people think of, well, if you have to put this material away from everyone forever, how do you best do it? And Yucca Mountain was the scientist's answer to that. And from my point of view is, how do you best make use of the byproducts of any industrial process? How do you reduce, reuse, and recycle? And if you ask that question, you come up with a far different answer than taking all the material, shipping it as far away as you possibly can, and burying it as deep underground as you can afford to dig.
Yeah, and that's, this whole waste issue, I think, is one that hasn't had enough attention paid to it from the nuclear community. And that may come as a surprise to some people to hear me say that. They may think, you know, oh, we think about nuclear waste all the time. It's all we ever talk about. But for 50 years, our answer in the nuclear community is, what do you do with nuclear waste? And we know nuclear waste consists of several different things. You've got the unburned uranium, you've got the fission products, and you've got the transuranic actinides, neptunium, plutonium, americium, curium, the sort of the unburned fuel. I think of it as like the incomplete combustion.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is to really get rid of those transuranics and the uranium, you need a fast-spectrum reactor. So the answer's always been, well, let's go build these fast-spectrum reactors. Will go, and this is exactly what's going on now with the proposed GNET program, is to build fast-spectrum burners, because with this stuff, you just can't get rid of it in a thermal spectrum. It just kind of smolders in a thermal spectrum. The thorium alternative to that is, with the thorium reactors, you don't make it in the first place, that you can actually burn up the thorium /U-233 completely in the reactor. You can run the reactor in a way that you don't produce any transuranics, and you can create a waste stream that only consists of fission products. And those fission products will decay the background levels of the radiation in just a few hundred years. So, you know, we've often read the anti-nuclear opposition says, well, there's no solution to nuclear waste. Well, you know, I kind of say, well, what nuclear waste are you talking about? If it's fission products, which is the true nuclear waste, then the answer is nature lets it decay pretty quickly. You leave it alone for a few hundred years, and it's gone. If it's transuranic nuclear waste, the answer is to burn in the fast spectrum, and best solution of all, in my opinion, is don't make it in the first place. If you can generate nuclear energy in a way that doesn't produce troublesome waste products, and I don't know, there are probably people who would disagree with me that the fission products are not troublesome. I would, you know, and that'd certainly be a point for contention. But if you can do that, that's a pretty compelling and intriguing alternative.
Yeah, I've got a couple of readers on my various blogs who have done some significant amount of work in studying what actually fission products consist of and what potential uses they can make of all of those various materials. And again, if you kind of look at the residues of nuclear fission processes like we do the residues of most industrial processes, at least in well-run industries, you try to figure out how to make use of it. You know, you use everything but the squeal. And
that's a very good point, too, because one of the things that isn't appreciated, I think, also is how fast most fission products achieve stability. I give you an example. You know, within a few months, all the xenon has decayed to stable isotopes of xenon. I mentioned xenon because it's a gas. In a solid core reactor, fission product gases like xenon and krypton build up, and they tend to give you trouble. That's why you have gaps and so forth, and one of the reasons you have gaps in spacing of the fuel and plenums is to accommodate for gas buildup, but mm-hmm. it damages the fuel. In a liquid fuel reactor, gases like xenon and krypton come right out just in the action of pumping the fuel, and that's real nice for the reactor because then you can get rid of that pesky xenon-135, which is a huge neutron poison, but it also means that pulling off fission product gases and then later on distilling them and selling them would be really easy.
Right.
You could sell krypton 85. You could sell xenon to NASA for, you know, ion engines or something like that. And
xenon,
there's a lot of others. Pardon me.
Xenon. I was going to mention that. I've thought about mentioning this in a few shows when we've talked about fission products before, but xenon is too expensive to use as a general anesthetic. But it is actually possible to put someone under with pretty much none of the side effects of using general anesthetics that are currently used in surgery by replacing the nitrogen with xenon in an 80-20 mix, and you'll go right under.
That is really interesting. I did not know that.
It's because of the solubility of the inert gases in tissue, and it causes a very, very heavy narcotic effect, kind of like what happens in nitrogen when you're diving, but it happens at sea level.
Yeah, xenon... Shane is a big gas guy, by the way. He does a lot of diving, so he has informed us about an awful lot of various saturation diving techniques that I'd never heard of before.
That's interesting. I have my open water certification, but I haven't gone much further than that.
Yeah, this past year has been kind of quiet, but I'm hoping to get back out this before the winter goes away and I have to start dealing with kids landing on my head in the water.
You feel like you're
I could just see the advertisement. I could just see the advertisements of the future. The air you breathe was once in a nuclear reactor. Oh boy.
Yeah, xenon is, as a matter of fact, there's a really good book that Isaac Asimov did back in the 60s called Noble Gases. And that's one of the several places where I found the snippet of information about xenon being usable as a general anesthetic. The other thing is that the xenon that is present in the atmosphere of the Earth comes in 9 different stable isotopes. All of them are traceable to spontaneous fission of thorium and uranium isotopes.
Wow. So actively fissioning, we would really increase the amount of xenon that might be available.
Well, think about it. The amount of xenon that's in the atmosphere of the Earth is very, very small percentage. It's like maybe a 100,000th of a percent of the atmosphere. And that's for an awful lot of uranium and thorium having gone. If what little human beings can burn of it, you'd have to go and look at the yield rates for xenon. I mean, there's a whole... the entire center of the chart of the nuclei, if you look at it, all those squares that have little triangles down in the corner, there's an awful lot of range in there on the fission product curve. So Yeah, the other thing is that the argon that constitutes 1% of the atmosphere, almost all of it comes from the decay of potassium. But because argon is too heavy to escape the Earth's atmosphere, it's just built up.
Oh, okay.
Yep, and most of the helium that we found is what used to be alpha particles.
Yeah, that's always one of the
nuclear waste dump already.
Yeah, I like to tell people at parties, you know that helium in your balloon is it came from a radioactive decay of uranium and thorium. They look a little strange at me. And needless to say, I get invited to a lot of parties with talk like that.
Well, I think that, you know, we're all probably, you know, some of the top guests of parties. You know, people always want to come and chat about nuclear energy topics and hear about proactinium and a few other things.
Or roll their eyes and try to get away as far away as possible. Much like when I do my party trick of, guess how many radioactive isotopes I can find in your house.
I would like to see that trick. Well, I think, you know, pulling back a little bit, though, I think the waste issue is a real legitimate one to bring up, because it seems to be one where anti-nuclear factions have gotten a lot of traction, and it's one where I think there are valid technical solutions to the problem. The problem is they're not really the ones we're doing right now. One of the things that troubles me about the GNAP approach, supposedly on paper, to solving our waste issue is that it's going to require about, depends on who you talk to, but 2 to 3 fast burners for every 5 or 6 light water reactor type reactors that we're going to have out there. I mean, that's a lot of fast burners to just sort of keep where we are right now. But if we could get to an alternative scenario where we weren't producing these transuranics in the reactor in the first place, you know, maybe nuclear energy would make more palatable for somebody like Harry Reid or Al Gore. I'm thinking of Al Gore because I watched his movie last night, so kind of got Al Gore on the mind today.
Well, Al Gore is also, I'm becoming more optimistic about Al Gore's stance on nuclear energy, basically. And he's come around from where it seemed to me like he was 10 years ago, 13 years ago when they killed IFR with extreme prejudice. And that was a Clinton administration decision. And at the time, it seemed like Al Gore was one of the prime drivers. And recently, he's been asked several times during interviews what he thinks the role of nuclear power is, and he's not out and out said, heck, demon.
No, you know, I've written about Al Gore's position on nuclear power, and I personally believe, first of all, that Al Gore was part of the Clinton administration, but certainly not as big an influence on the policy as, say, Dick Cheney is on the current policy. You know, he was the chosen running mate and served as a vice president and did the vice president job pretty well. And throughout history, vice presidents don't have a huge impact on policy. I personally think that
there's a quote from James Madison about that. Yeah, I think it was either James Madison or one of the later presidents in the first half of the 19th century. The vice presidency is worth a pitcher of warm spit.
Well, going back to Al Gore, and getting away from spit, by the way.
Well, I'm watching Al Gore last night, and he's talking about, gee, we got to go stop global warming. And I'm sitting there thinking, you know, Al, I really have something I want to tell you about here, because I think it might solve some of your issues with nuclear power. You know, I think you might find this to be not quite the same thing you've encountered up to this point.
Well, I don't think Al Gore. I think Al Gore's had a long-term knowledge and understanding of nuclear power, dating back to listening to his father talk about it as a member of the Joint Committee on Atomic Energy back in the 50s. And Al's also from Tennessee, which of course has always had a fairly major relationship with nuclear power, with Oak Ridge and all that kind of stuff. Major employer.
Home of the fluoride reactor.
Oh, exactly. But and even if you read Earth in the Balance, Al is not anti-nuclear. He simply dismisses nuclear powers or the nuclear industry's chances of success. And that's kind of what he's done recently. Is he says, you know, I agree that nuclear is an option, but I don't see it happening. And you know, if you read his statement and read it right next to the statements of some of the people from the Nuclear Energy Institute, it's not too terribly different. They both say, well, you know, we kind of think that we can maintain our current 20% market share, and that's about it.
Well, that, and that, you know, Rod, I know you've written a lot about this, and I've really enjoyed your writings, but this is certainly one of those things where I think there is more of a story here to tell with the fluoride reactor and thorium. And you think to yourself, I read an article recently about when they built Plant Vogtle in Georgia, and they talked about the cement plants they built and the industrial operation they had to put that plant together and just how mammoth it was. And one of the locals said the biggest thing that ever happened here was the Civil War in Plant Vogtle, you know. And I thought to myself, you know, gas turbines have been so popular over the last 15 years because they have really low capital costs. You know, you essentially, this may be an oversimplification, but you know, you call up GE, you order one, it comes in, you pour a slab, plug into a gas line, and off you go making power. So what have we done over the last 15 years? Well, we've put in tons and tons of natural gas turbines. Problem is, natural gas is an expensive, you know, boutique type fuel, and cheap gas wasn't going to last forever. Now it's real expensive, and we're back to saying, gee, you know, is it coal or nuclear? Coal, if you don't count all the potential carbon regulations, is pretty cheap stuff. I don't know if you've read Big Coal. I read that recently. Boy, great book. Great book. Highly recommend Big Coal by Jeff Goodell. But he talks about the dangers of coal are external. You know, there's a lot of externalities, whereas nuclear takes care of all its externalities. You know, it funds a waste fund and so on and so forth. But you've got to get past this capital cost. You know, if we've got to build you know, a huge concrete containment and giant cooling towers and a 10-meter pressure vessel with 9-inch thick steel walls. You know, those are not processes that give themselves to being built in a factory very well. Those are big, specific operations. And I think if we're going to increase nuclear energy beyond 20%, if we're actually going to say, dang it, we're going to do something about global warming, or we're going to do something about foreign energy dependence, we've got to build a lot of nuclear reactors, and we've got to build them smaller and simpler and safer and easier. And there's a lot of advantages to going with a reactor where the reactor's operating at ambient pressure, like a fluoride reactor would. It doesn't have to operate at high pressure. The core runs at ambient pressure, has a very high core power density, and then you've got a fuel cycle that is essentially contained in the reactor. I mean, in the sense that you don't import fissile material in every year and export spent fuel out. You pull in thorium and you send out fission products, and that's it. You do everything else in the fuel cycle right there in the reactor area. So I think there's a potential for getting to this dream of assembly line construction of nuclear reactors, where you could really imagine a factory that's making reactors on an assembly line and shipping them out to where they need to go. And I think that's a pretty hard thing to imagine economically with a light water reactor. It's just so big.
Okay. I agree with 99% of what you just said, but let me ask you one more part of the question. Building reactors on the assembly line is a great step, but a reactor is essentially just the combustion chamber. It's just the heat source. What do you propose to use as these system that converts that heat energy into something useful, either motive, turning of a propulsor, a screw, or something that converts into electricity that people can use. What's your proposal?
That's a very good point. I had a little bit of a background in gas turbines, and as I was learning about fluoride reactors, I was thinking, gee, you know, they run at such high temperatures that it really seems like it would do well if combined with a closed-cycle gas turbine. And I was kind of surprised to go back in the Oak Ridge work and find out they were always trying to combine it with a steam turbine, you know, a typical Rankine cycle. And it really didn't work out too well because, you know, if you know a little about Rankine cycle, steam turbine or steam cycles is, you know, you're limited by the properties of whatever your working fluid is, the vapor dome of the fluid. And water only goes so hot before it's, you know, it's supercritical, and, you know, there's all kinds of issues with running supercritical. Some plants do it. But with a closed-cycle gas turbine, you can really take advantage of that high-temperature performance of the reactor. And another thing that's real interesting about a closed-cycle gas turbine as opposed to an open-cycle gas turbine is that initial pressure to the cycle is a variable. with opacycle turbine, it's whatever you suck in the gas at. So, you know, it's ambient pressure for an open cycle turbine. With a closed cycle turbine, that's a knob you can turn. And what's so significant about that knob is that knob scales the size of the turbo machinery. So if you say, I want a smaller turbo machine that's going to generate the same power, you can essentially turn up that inlet pressure, preserving the pressure ratio across the turbo machine, and you can get a smaller unit. And I've talked with some friends of mine who are gas turbine experts who've done modeling on this, and it's just been really amazing as we go in there and say, gee, how big would the gas turbines for a 1,000 megawatt electric fluoride reactor plant be? And come to find out that they are very tractable. They're something you could build in the factory because they operate at such high pressure compared with a steam cycle, where when you're in that final low-pressure turbine, the thing's huge. I mean, if you've seen the inside of a steam turbine hall at a power plant, that last big rotor that's just, you know, a couple stories tall is the last real low-pressure stage of the steam turbine. So what I'm getting at is there's a way to make the reactor small. There's a way to make the power conversion system small. And so when you've got all those pieces put together, you start to say, wow, do I really have a package here for a system that can be built economically, quickly, in a factory, and could actually be deployed in a very large fashion.
Kirk, do you know of anybody who has actually built a large closed-cycle gas turbine machine, or even a moderately sized closed-cycle gas turbine machine, and operated at high inlet pressures?
Yeah, the Germans built a number of them in the 60s and 70s, both closed-cycle on air and on helium. Closed-cycle gas turbine with helium is the basis for the PBMR, the pebble bed modular reactor design.
Mm-hmm.
There's another reactor. That's the direct gas cooled reactor. I know you're very familiar with that one. You've been very interested in that. And it's definitely a technology that is not in large industrial use right now, because frankly we don't have any heat source that is compatible with it right now. We don't have nuclear reactors that run at those high temperatures. Our light water reactors certainly don't. But maybe I'm just being blithely optimistic here, but I really think it's something we can do. And Rod, you'd mentioned to me, you know, we're spending billions to upgrade, you know, conventional gas turbines. How can we expect to be able to pull this off? And I thought to myself, well, we're spending billions to eke out the last, you know, percent or so from some of these conventional gas turbines, whereas a closed cycle helium turbine is a way to get into some incredible efficiencies and economies that have not even hardly been explored thus far. So I may be incredibly quietly optimistic here, but I really think it's something that's tractable and doable.
Well, one of the areas that's always interested technologists or energy technologists with regard to the closed cycle gas turbine is using it as a heat engine for another high temperature heat source where the fuel is pretty cheap, and that's called a coal plant. There have been a number of attempts over several countries to do that, because coal does combust at a rather high temperature, and as you mentioned, there are some limitations of steam plants. And as far as I can tell, all of those activities, all of those experimentations have been not successful, and I'm not sure exactly why, but I know some of the technical challenges they faced. One of them was in the heat exchanger temperature limits of the piping that was available to run the gas through to keep it clean.
Yeah, and running a coal gas turbine, I think, is probably more challenging than running something like a natural gas turbine, where you've got a much cleaner burning fuel that's not coking or fouling nearly to the degree of a coal system. I mean, you know, maybe you do something like you gasify the coal, or you syngas or something, but there's also, until I got into modeling gas turbine cycles, and I've got a Java program on my website that you can play with, and you can, you know, look at different gas turbine cycles.
And
I appreciate
it. And I do, by the way. I have played with that, and
great.
I like it a lot. I appreciate the tool. It's very useful to me.
I tried to put it out there so, you know, people could spend a whole lot less time getting smart on gas turbines than it took me. You know, I was sketching TS diagrams and so forth by hand, and I thought, you know, there's got to be a better way to do this. So, but one of the things that really amazed me was just how different an open cycle and a closed cycle gas turbine are. You know, I had thought, gee, something like a GE engine in an airplane isn't all that different from a closed cycle turbine. Turns out they're really different because you end up optimizing them in totally different ways. With the open cycle system, you want to go to this real high pressure ratio, and there's thermodynamic reasons that I won't bore you with for why you want to do that. With closed cycle systems, you end up going just the opposite. You want to go with a very low pressure ratio in a highly regenerated system. And what ends up happening is, you know, mass shows up in different places in the plant than others. You know, the turbo machinery gets lighter and the heat exchangers get bigger. But one of the tricks you can do with a fluoride reactor and a gas turbine is you can have, it's almost like putting several of those simple cycles together, and it's called a multiple reheat cycle. And it doesn't change the efficiency, but what it does change is you get a lot more work out of each kilogram per second of helium. And the upshot of all that is, for the same power level, you can get about a third of the size of turbo machinery with a multi-reheat system as you can with a single heat, like that you would use in a direct gas-cooled reactor. So you can really reduce turbo machinery size just in that technique alone while preserving efficiency.
Now, I looked at your thorium forum that's linked from your Energy from Thorium blog. Pretty interesting discussions already started, but it looked to me like you had a proposal that was worked on by some folks out at the Navy Postgraduate School.
Yeah, it was kind of a fortuitous situation. My boss took a position as a professor out there at the NPS, so we had an opportunity to talk with some of the students out there about the future of the Navy and you know, Rod, you and I have corresponded about this for a number of years now, actually. This has been a great interest of mine. And we talked with the students out there who were doing a ship design, and essentially they said to us, gee, you know, we really got to figure out a way to build a ship that doesn't run on combustion fuel, because it's just getting more and more expensive. And as we extrapolate out in the future, it's looking pretty bad for the Navy to keep using this. And this apparently was a point that was backed up by a number of the professors and the admirals that were serving there at the NPS. But then I looked over some of their design work for the last several years, and I said, well, it looks like you guys haven't ever really considered nuclear. And they said, well, we did, but, you know, it's always we try to talk to naval reactors, and they tell us it's all classified, and so we don't really get anywhere, whereas the gas turbine stuff we can look up on the Internet. So we got a little bit of a discussion about using a fluoride reactor on a ship and talked about, you know, would this be feasible? So in this semester's design, they incorporated a fluoride reactor and a helium gas turbine power conversion system. And, you know, we didn't get very deep into the details. We mainly sketched out overall masses and volumes, and I used a lot of sort of rule of thumb factors as far as, you know, core power density and weights and so forth, just to give us a rough idea we were looking at. But it was, and I tried to err very heavily with a lot of, you know, if I thought, you know, it's this light or it's this heavy, I tried to err and it's this heavy. But it turned out it fit very well on the ship, and the ship design required a lot of electrical power. It had a couple of rail guns on it, so it was a real power hog. But it turned out to be a pretty good fit with the ship, and they really liked it. And so I'm hoping that we will get an opportunity to, work with other design groups there at NPS and see if this might be an interesting solution for them.
Sounds like an interesting one.
I was going to ask before, we're coming up on 45 minutes. We're probably going to, I don't know how much longer Rod was planning on running, but I had a couple quick questions I wanted to get in. Number one, materials. There is fluorine involved in a fluoride reactor, and granted, the fuel is in the form of a fluoride salt, and fluoride is about the most clingy atom that there is in the periodic table in terms of not giving up its space next to a fission product or a uranium or a thorium or a transuranic and pretty much any other element. But I wonder whether they did any tests on corrosion. I think I may have read some of the information from Oak Ridge about this, but What do they do in the way of corrosion testing and materials compatibility? And did they see any problems with heat exchangers?
It's a very good question, and they spent an enormous amount of time and money on corrosion questions, because it was one of the first things that came up, you know, when you're dealing with fluorine or fluorides. But as you put it, fluorides are very chemically stable. Probably the most stable salt in the world is something like, I don't know, cesium fluoride, you know, something with a heavy alkali metal and a light halogen. But the basis of the chemical stability of the reactor is the idea that the fluorine would rather be lithium fluoride or beryllium fluoride than it would rather be chromium fluoride or iron fluoride or some type of corrosion fluoride. So the real trick is to make sure that there's always enough stuff in there to keep fluorines from finding an unpleasant home. And I talked with one of the chemists that worked on the program, and he said they came up with a very nifty trick how to do this, and it was controlling a slight balance between uranium trifluoride and uranium tetrafluoride. And he said if we can control this, the redox potential, he called it, the reduction oxidation potential. He said if we can control this value, we can essentially turn corrosion off, chemical, you know, fluorine-type corrosion in the reactor. They didn't do it when they ran the molten salt reactor experiment in the 60s. They were able to run that reactor successfully without doing any active redox control, but he realized that this is really the way to go in the future. I said, is it very hard to do this? You know, is this a real difficult situation? He said, no, it's not difficult. Every now and then you drop a little metallic beryllium in and it drinks up a little extra fluorine and you just maintain that balance just right. He goes, it's sort of like the reactor has to take a vitamin every week or two, and that's about all there is to it. There are some other...
I was going to ask, how much is a little beryllium?
Like I said, it's kind of like an aspirin tablet.
Sure. So yeah, I figured it's small, but there, beryllium is a material that really has an awful lot of control on it. And if we're looking at ways of keeping the regulatory burden on new reactor designs low using materials that have that kind of chemical hazard potential, I imagine he's probably got a few other things up his sleeve from somewhere on that column of the periodic table that might not work as well, but they'd probably be reasonable. But
well, yeah, that may be the case. There's another issue that they came about, they figured out with the molten salt reactor experiment, that was tellurium. Tellurium ended up being a bit of a problem. Not a strong problem, but they found out when they sort of did the post-mortem on the reactor that the tellurium had gotten into some of the metal and caused some corrosion. And I looked at tellurium again on the periodic table, and it's right there in the same column as oxygen. And so it's kind of like oxygen. It kind of tends to rust it out. But again, the same chemist told me, you know, we figured out essentially how to also control the tellurium issue through this redox balance. We didn't do it, but we could have done it. We would do it on a future reactor. And then... finally, as far as corrosion goes, there is some damage that occurs to the metals of the vessel. Past alloy N was the special alloy they used, a nickel-based alloy. And they had to do some modifications to it to account for getting rid of these residual corrosion problems. But this was all stuff that by about 1976, when they shut down the molten salt reactor program, they pretty much had licked. And it's very well documented in the... molten salt reactor semi-annual reports that I have on my blog site, and you know, literally page after page talking about how we put the corrosion problem to bed. Now, it's not a general solution for every salt combination and every reactor material combination, but it is a combination that works for lithium fluoride, beryllium fluoride, uranium fluoride, and this halfway end. And those are really that's really the salt combination you want to use for a thorium reactor. It's very well proven is this is the way to go. This is the right stuff to use, and there's really not a lot of difference of opinion as far as whether that's the right salt to use or not. So I would say the corrosion problem is really one that was put to bed, and put to bed well by Oak Ridge. I hope there's people that can still make these nifty alloys that they figured out would work, but I think it's been very well addressed.
Hey, Kirk, I want to really thank you for coming on the show. You've got some fascinating information and some a great blog, and I encourage people to go visit and get involved in the Energy from Thorium Forum that you have just started up.
Yeah, that would be great. I really want to encourage people to come on. Let's talk about this stuff. You know, let's hey, if there's a better way to do nuclear energy, I'd certainly love to learn about it, you know.
Well, I'd like to echo Rod's appreciation for coming on. It's been a fun conversation.
Well, I want to thank you guys for inviting me on, and especially want to thank Rod for giving me the impetus to go down this path in the first place. It's been very rewarding, so thank you for taking the time to educate a lot of people like me about nuclear energy.
No problem. All right, folks. I hope you all have a great week, and we'll talk to you next time.
There's got to be a better way to light up the world today. Something that we need, something safe and clean. Well, if you're searching, you can find the answer right before your eyes. It's atomic. It's atomic. It's atomic.
You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.